Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Evelyn Pierce. Evelyn Pierce's completed projects include published short stories and two contracted screenplay adaptations. She's presently finishing her novel, Latchahatchee, which she'll read from tonight. She's taught writing since 1983 and is the recipient of multiple teaching honors, her most recent in 2004 for sustained excellence in teaching at Carnegie Mellon University, where she's an associate teaching professor. She received her MFA from the University of Pittsburgh and facilitates the Mad Women in the Attic fiction workshops at Carlow University. Hi, Evelyn. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi. Thanks for asking me.
Could you start off reading something from Latchahatchee, and maybe you can set it up a little bit for us?
Sure. This is the opening of the book, and in this section I'm about to read, your audience may think, oh, wow, it's going a lot of different directions. It's a first-person narrative, and she does. She goes off on a lot of different tangents, but eventually the story starts to pull together. I call this as a working section. Someone owes me an apology, big time. I'm somewhat befuddled by the incidents of late surrounding the wedding ceremony of my little sister Francine. It all started last Thursday morning at 6 o'clock when I got this telephone call from my mother. She said, "Egg." Now right here, I'd better stop and explain how I got such a name. First, my real name is not Egg, but is Peggy Dean. Dean is my middle name, not my last. I know it's a rather strange name, and I owe the privilege, if one can call it that, to my great-grandmother Maudlene, who for some ungodly reason named her 5 children, Bodine, Doreen, Lorraine, Roxine, and Maxine, born in that order. I firmly believe that Granny Maudlene lived beneath lofty illusions of grandeur about one day becoming a famous poet. She just never got past that rhyme stage. Nevertheless, she held enough influence over each of her children to make them swear that they'd each name their offspring in the same way, start a tradition, so to speak. All bore fruit, multiplied, and remained true to their words except the youngest, who were twins, by the way, great-aunts Maxine and Roxine. Great-aunt Maxine never married and died suddenly at the age of 72 from an overdose of sweet potatoes, cornbread, fried chicken, black-eyed peas, rutabagas, hominy catfish, and peach cobbler at the Clearwater Baptist Church's dinner on the grounds one 4th of July. Personally, I think what made her run off the road that fatal day was not severe indigestion, but what I saw her pour into her iced tea from the little silver flasks she kept in her handbag. But far be it from me to form a conclusion in direct contradiction to the beliefs of everyone in the Baptist Church. As for Great Aunt Roxine, well, she was the only child not to name her offspring in the promised fashion, and for that reason, she remained the black sheep of the family until the day she died. She once told me that the system of nomenclature in the Southern family species is one not to be questioned. It's unexplainable. One can either accept it or discard it, but either way it survives. My granddaddy Bodine was, and still is, a believer. He sired my mother Earline and her sister Lurline. I have cousins named Modine, Jodine, and Christine. I have 12 second cousins once removed named Kathleen, Maureen, Nadine. Oh, well, you get the picture. So in spite of being named Peggy Dean after granddaddy, I've learned to accept it and life has gone on. I still find it hard, however, to be known as Egg. My sister Francine created this alias when she was less than one and couldn't say Peggy, but could clearly mouth out Egg. Mother thought it so cute that it stuck, causing, I might add, much consternation in my before, during, and after adolescent periods. The only person in the family who knows better than to call me by this name is Francine herself, who I threatened as soon as she could rightfully understand. I held her prized Barbie over a heaping bonfire until she swore in earnest to never say the word in my presence again. Now, about that phone call last Thursday at 6 a.m., as soon as I wake up enough to make it to the phone and pick up the receiver, Mother says, "Egg, come home now. I need you." And then she hangs up. In my mind, this can only mean one thing. Granddaddy has passed away. It was just the obvious thing for me to think of upon such a rude awakening because he just turned 89. And since I'm fond of him, his impending death plays on my mind at the oddest moments. And to make matters worse, all his sisters have passed on quite suddenly in their old age. Aunt Roxine, at age 76, was just walking down the streets of Lachahatchee at midnight, as she was prone to do, when death knocked her down. Aunt Doreen died at age 83 in her sleep. Aunt Lorraine was 84 when she hit the gym mat like a lead weight while doing her aerobics at the spa she'd opened only a couple of years before. And you remember Aunt Maxine, who ate herself to death. Well, each one of them was in perfect health up until the moment of death, just like Granddaddy is now, so you can see why I worry about him. I guess I might as well tell you the other reason I thought it was Granddaddy's time. If you knew my mother, then you'd know from talking on the phone with her that she will talk on and on about anything except who passed away. When Daddy passed, I had this small episode that eventually led to my two-week respite in Whitfield. So Mother walks around on eggshells when somebody dies, thinking I might have some kind of recurrence, which is so funny, I forget to laugh.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Evelyn Pierce, reading from her novel in progress, Lachahatchee. You know, after that kind of litany of names, I almost feel like calling you Eveline, but I won't do that to you.
That's okay. I get it all.
So I want to start by asking you, this is a first novel for you that you're working on. So one, I think that's, you know, interesting for people. I think everybody either thinks they have a novel in them or they're in the process of writing that novel. So why the novel? Since you've already done some screen adaptations, what about the form was enticing?
Just a little background on why this novel, why this subject matter. It was about a year and a half ago. I read an essay by the guy, he might still be the fiction editor of the Atlantic Monthly, and he said that nobody writes literary humor anymore. And I thought, that's not true. But why don't I give it a shot? I mean, maybe not enough people are doing it.
That's a challenge on his part.
Right, you would think. And so I thought, what would be interesting? And just asking the question, I had this kind of voice spring to mind. And as I tried to begin to capture it, and I saw her going off in all these tangents, I knew what the end of the story would be. But I knew that there would be many diverging roads that would have to come back together for me to get to the end, which is this wedding, this big event in their lives. And as I began writing, it was just so much bigger than a short story. And I knew I had to, you know, kind of follow, I think, the voice, see where it took me. And it looked like it would be more novel-esque.
So when you started the writing, what were the, I guess, if you hadn't written a novel before, and particularly I'm thinking about the fact that screenplays have kind of a very set framework. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with a time medium. You have to think about how it translates to the screen, how many people are involved, all those kind of things.
Oh, yeah.
And this novel from the beginning is very fluid. You don't have to worry about how many actors to pay, if it translates, if it gets picked up. So, but what were some of the challenges that you found that, or it could even be the pleasures that are different, or both?
Well, the pleasure, I think you've hit upon it. You know, what I loved about working on the screenplays is that it is a collaborative process. And as you're writing, even though they were two adaptations, I had to, you know, keep in mind what the cameraman needed to see, what especially the director needed to get from this, you know, first look at this work, in order to see the possibility. But you're really writing for the camera eye. And more than anything, though, I like writing, capturing voice. So the beauty of this for me was I can bring in all the voices at different times. You know, there's so much dialogue here, as you can hear already. The hard part, though, I've mostly written in third person. I've enjoyed third person as a you know point of view, and and with this one in first person, I've had to stop myself and wait a minute. She's been talking too much. You know, you got to ground her. You don't want it just to be a voice that floats all the time. You know, where are people standing? You know, when do they sit down? You know, when does all this?
So finding. So the skills that you rely on the most for your screenplay and adaptations are the skills that kind of went in the back room.
Right.
As you were doing
absolutely.
This
absolutely.
Really interesting. Well, and I think as you're talking about the voice, the title, you know, maybe we can come back to that after hearing a little bit more from the piece. But it's very obviously it's a Southern voice. It mm-hmm. feels very epic from the beginning. I mean, there are things in it, you know, even the fact of the litany of names. I mean, we can pull from all of the biggies. That's biblical. You know, we've got Moby Dick, Call Me Ishmael.
Right.
And then also the fact that there's a wedding involved. That's very classic, you know, Shakespearean. You've either got a wedding or a funeral or,
right.
or a battle
right.
kind of thing. So, you know, this is a voice that's a big voice. It is going to meander around a bit. And you said it just came to you. Is this a voice that was familiar to you, or it feels like it was?
It felt very familiar to me, but it's if you listen to some of the word choice that she, you know, it's natural for her, befuddled. You know, that's a very old-fashioned word, and this is set in 1982. So who is this person who uses language like this? Consternation, you know, incessant, banshee. You know, where does that come from? I don't talk like that, but she was very familiar to me. And I have asked myself that same question, where does that, you know, have I heard this voice before? And I, you know, I was so lucky growing up in Mississippi. I think it still holds true for people growing up there now. I know MTV has changed every region of the United. You got cable TV everywhere. We all changed. We're much more homogenous than we've ever been. But growing up when I did, everybody told stories. You know, when you say hello in the grocery store, people launch into stories about their days and what they know their neighbors are doing. So I'm sure that I've, you know, drawn together some voices from my own life, from my past, the people, and wonderful storytellers in my family, grandmothers especially, my mother, my aunt, yeah.
Yeah. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Evelyn Pierce. Evelyn, would you read some more for us?
Sure. Let me flip to another section here. She finally, Peggy Dean, finally begins to get to the part where she gets home. And greets her mother. Granddaddy's not dead after all. He's mowing the yard at the church where his sister's going to get married. But before she finds out why her sister, who's already married, is getting married, she has to hear the scoop on a beau her mother has in mind for her, or so Peggy Dean thinks at the time, Travis. And they go through that whole piece there. So let me turn to that and read.
Great.
That part about Travis. Is this why you had me rush home? She ignored me. Travis T's building a mansion, Egg. I mean a mansion right outside of town. I knew right then and there I'd have to wade through the poop on Travis T. Gillespie before I'd ever find out why she summoned me home. Travis T. is this well-to-do middle-aged lawyer, and Mother's obsessed with hooking the two of us together for life. For me, the sentence would be worse than death row, and no matter how hard I've tried, I've never been able to convince her why. I told her he's got longer-than-average fingernails, and she's told me, but they're clean. I've never seen nails so clean. I pointed out his rat whiskers mustache, all thin and blonde and constantly twitching. She replied, I think it's distinguished. And after our one and only date, I even told her his breath smells like week-old mashed potatoes, which it does. All she said was, be ashamed. You know, call to put a man down because of his occasional irregularities. In her eyes, he's Rhett Butler, John F. Kennedy, and Billy Graham, all rolled into one. I listened to her describe the mansion and say, so what? A place like that just has more toilets to clean. And she continued, he's entering the state Senate race this year. I couldn't resist the urge. I'd rather see Nixon as president again. In exasperation, she thumped her spoon on the table. You don't know how to appreciate anything. Well, it's not like I didn't try to dampen Mother's fixation on Travis T and me long ago. I even went on a date with him last year to nip her intentions along with any convoluted dreams Travis T himself might have had about us. Throughout our evening together, I spoke hardly a word except to complain about the weather, the restaurant, the food, the movie, my life, his life, and the general state of the world, including any specifics I could muster pertaining to the law. When he said, you have a fascinating way of viewing the world, I knew the night was a loss for me. So on the drive home, all complained out. I fell asleep and didn't wake until we rolled into the driveway. Without a word, I jumped out of the car, slammed the door, and didn't once look back until I was inside. Surely that night I was the most obnoxious date any man could have. But as fate would have it, Travis T didn't think so. He proved to me just how backward he really is by calling me for a whole week and asking me out every night. Finally, when pushed to my limit, I spelled it out in black and white. Travis T, I said, if we ever found ourselves on a desert island together, I'd kill you so as to have the place to myself, you understand me? I'd murder you in cold blood and not flinch an inch. For a moment, he didn't speak and almost began to feel ashamed, kind of like kicking a sick dog sort of feeling. But then he said, believe it or not, I seem to have called upon you at a bad time. Do forgive me, Peggy Dean. Shall I call tomorrow? Now, that kind of talk may turn and spin some women's heads, but to me it spelled one thing. I said, you are a jackass, and slammed down the receiver. Then, without so much as a word, I packed my things and moved clear up the state to the end of nowhere and got me a comfortable trailer and a waitress job where I've been ever since. I do get home for Christmas and funerals, but that's about it. Anything I find out about home, I learn from Mother or Francine by phone or read about it in the Lachahatchee Chronicle Weekly. Compliments of Aunt Lurleen, publisher, editor, and senior staff writer, who has it delivered right to my trailer doorstep.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Evelyn Pierce, reading from her novel in progress, Lachahatchee. So let's talk about Lachahatchee.
Yeah.
It's Ketchahatchee.
Yeah, is it? Good. That's what I was hoping. But, you know, the state of Mississippi, like the state of Pennsylvania, like many states, full of wonderful names of towns that come from Native American, names for the places. And Mississippi has so many names. Pelahatchie was one that I was always drawn to as a kid. And then there's, of course, the Billy Joe McAllister jumping off in the Tallahatchie Bridge. And in thinking of my place, I thought, you know, this is supposed to be kind of funny, but I wanted to choose something that could possibly be. I didn't want it to be a real town. And I didn't want it to be, you know, like Faulkner's Yachna Patafa, which is really a name he pulled right from a river, a real river. So I made it up. You know, I thought, what? And I just, I guess, as a poet might, I'm not a poet. I can't be a poet. I've tried. But as a poet might, I just played with sounds and rhymes, and I came up Lachahatchee, and I thought, that sounds kooky enough, but real enough.
So let's go back a little bit to your discussion about the prompt of trying to write literary humor.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the things that you're looking for? I mean, I think a lot of people think humor just happens, but it's very crafted, and it requires a lot of timing. So when you're writing it, what is it that you're looking for that you think it's working?
You know, I think about stories I've told to friends about my real family, and how they've died laughing at things that I think are quite serious, that are not that funny. And so I've let my friends, my colleagues over the years, teach me what to them sounds funny. And I, with this particular character and the circumstances here, I have tried to be very aware not to let it become too slapstick, but to try to keep a balance between the drama and the melodrama. I mean, some of it is quite melodramatic. You know, it's foiled by an innocent maid, oh my. But, you know, I didn't want it to go too far in that direction. So that's been another very difficult thing for me to try to manage, truly.
Now, do you read it to other people at all to see how it resonates, or is it just kind of work it through in your own head?
What I've been reading today, I read one other time to a group of people who came to hear some of the Mad Women in Fiction, Mad Women in the Attic and the Fiction Group read. And I got a lot of really strong response. And so I thought, okay, I can go home and write this somewhere. I think I'm going in the right direction. And it was really great to get that public feedback, people I didn't know who said things. And I got another, 100 or 50 pages out of that.
Excellent. That's a good night.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen the writer David Sedaris read, and he's really
known he is hysterical.
And when he reads his work, you can see he's test marketing it. He always usually tries one or two new pieces, and he has a pen in hand, and he'll mark where people laugh and also where they don't laugh that I think he has anticipated that they might.
So. Yeah, and he is someone I've read a lot, and I more than anything, I love to hear him read, and I've gotten to hear him read in person and, of course, on NPR. And I think he also, much better than I can, but he tries to have that, I think, fine balance between too much, something that's overblown, histrionic, melodramatic, and what really is, I think, at its core, drama, and sometimes quite sad.
Yeah, and even in the piece that you just read, there's something about politeness as well. That I think, the idea of being insulted and your reaction is to be polite back to it. There is something we just kind of smile about that. And I think some of it is just human experience.
Yes.
We've all had those moments where, then we go back home and scream at somebody we know about what just happened. But in the moment, we're very polite. I'm sure to an outsider, it would seem hysterical.
Yeah. It's always funnier when it happens to somebody else.
Absolutely. Would you read a little more?
Sure. We're skipping ahead a little bit now. We've gotten through the entire Travis piece, and now she is, wanting to really know what's going on. Francine, her sister, enters the scene. And that's when Francine stuck her head in the dining room. "What crime?" she asked. Her timing was perfect, like a tag team partner ready to jump into the ring. Mother began squalling. "What have you done to her?" Francine asked, her sponge curlers bobbing against her head and around her face. "This time," she added, looking at me. And before I could get a word in edgewise, Mother said, "Egg's been chewing my head off since she walked into this house." "I have not. Just chewing me into little pieces," cried Mother. "Chew, chew, chew." Francine glared at me and said, "Be ashamed, your own mother." She rushed to Mother and rocked her in a hug. "She won't be cussing you while I'm here," she said. "Just you let her try." I had to stand up for myself. "I haven't said much of anything," I said. "I don't even know why I'm here." Mother blew her nose and said, "She hasn't given me a chance to tell her about your wedding." "Not that she'd care," said Francine. "What's this about a wedding?" Francine put her hands on her hips. "If you have to know, Miss Smarty," she said, "Nero and I are getting married in the church on Saturday." "But didn't you just get married last month?" I said. "Yes," Francine said, but Mother said, who can switch gears faster than a race car driver, "last Friday, Lurleen was at the Cut and Curl getting her hair fixed when she heard from some very prominent and reliable sources that all of Lachahatchee's talking. I was confused about what. Really, Egg, Mother said, you know. Know what? And then it was Francine's turn to start with the tears. They're saying that because I eloped to Alabama and didn't get married in the church, that I must have had to get married. Like you're pregnant, I asked. What else, said Mother. I looked at Francine. Well, are you? Francine looked at me as if I'd thrown cold water in her face. Why, of course not, Peggy Dean, she said. You should know better, added Mother, and that I should. Nero is almost as short as he is wide, and never in my right mind could I imagine him fathering a child.
I think one of the other things that's just really delicious about the language you're using is the gossip. I mean, it really gives a shape to the place that is as tangible to me as the names and the characters. They're always kind of talking about each other and talking to someone who about a person that's standing right in the room.
I'm so pleased to hear you say that it comes across that way, because that was the other problem that I, again, not writing in first person as much, that I felt like I had. How to give a sense of the whole environment, you know? How does she capture that? And so I thought, well, let her go on the tangents. Maybe that'll do it. So I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yeah, well, I mean, gossip is, you know, it's a way that a community bonds together. Yeah. It's also, it's got movement to it. I mean, you can't have good gossip if you keep it to yourself.
Right.
It's not even gossip.
Right.
That's a secret. Yeah. So it can move around. And I was thinking about that in terms of when you were saying earlier that you weren't moving the characters physically as much, but it could be that, you know, the movement to me was really in the exchanges between the people about what they're saying about each other. And it did feel, I will say that's, and Egg's the one person who's got the different name.
Mm-hmm.
It did feel like she was the one kind of standing, even though she's the momentum behind everything, she's kind of standing outside of it and is often the subject or the prodder in terms of all this chatter that's going on in Lachahatchee.
Yeah. She, you know, the dark part of the book is that she's also the one that's probably, I think, most affected by it all. You know, she gets hurt most easily. She, you know, like I said, the name of this work, you know, the working name of this section, somebody owes me an apology. But it's really beyond that for her. She hasn't gotten over her father's death. And so some of these things come up throughout the book that, for her, create the real conflict here.
And do you have a full draft of the manuscript?
I have what I consider a full first draft, but that means some of it hasn't been typed yet.
Oh,
because I write a lot of things in longhand. You know, I like to go to a coffee shop to write, or, you know, even a fast food place, somewhere where I can be totally anonymous,
right,
and sit and get out of my own little space at home where the dishes, you know, need to be washed and the dog wants to be petted. And so,
your own Lachahatchee.
Yeah, right. And so, I haven't gone, you know, and typed up a lot of it yet. And then sometimes I just have to get back to the computer and type, because it's moving in that kind of quick a pace for me. So I got to get it all together. And then I think I'm ready to tighten it up and send it out, see what happens.
Well, great. Best of luck. Thanks for coming to Prosody tonight.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Ziggy Edwards and Amy Sutton. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.